You're listening to KCEA FM, Atherton, California.
Listening nightly to our favorite show, radio. Oh, why did you ever go? Oh, won't you please come back and entertain us? I long to turn the dial again to hear the past smile again, radio. I miss you so.
Once again, it's time for Yesteryear. A look back at your favorite dramas, westerns, comedies, and musical variety shows from the golden age of radio. Here's your host for Yesteryear, Craig Roberts.
Time once again to settle into your favorite easy chair for another hour of vintage radio. Later on, we'll open the case book of Gregory Hood. But first, on the lighter side, it's the Phil Harris and Alice Faye Show. Bandleader Phil Harris and movie star wife Alice Faye met in late 1933 when she was singing with Rudy Valley and Harris was leading the orchestra at New York's Lafayette Hotel. In his Fitch bandwagon days, the Harris-Faye show would sometimes become just an extension of Jack Benny's program. Benny would close with Harris saying, "So long, Jackson," and the scenario would pick up from there on the Fitch bandwagon. The action centered off and on Phil's home life with Alice and his kids. The Harris-Faye show ran on NBC's just after Benny, whom Harris still served as bandleader. Alice played herself, the movie star who had given up fame and glamour to be the wife and mother. Offstage, Harris had a reputation as a polite, almost shy man, a complete reversal of his radio image. The Phil Harris-Alice Faye show was last heard in 1954. Return with us now to those fabulous days of yesteryear with the Phil Harris-Alice Faye show and A New Suit of Clothes from October of 1948, another classic program from the radio vault of yesteryear.
Major Bowes, I miss the shadow nose, Fred Allen's alley folks, the laughter of Duffy's Tavern, Helen Trent, then we went to Can You Top This? Suspense in the Whistler sent those shivers up our spines. Uncle Don, I wish that he was on. Jack Armstrong, Merton, Marge, Amos, and Andy. I long to turn the dial again to hear the past smile again. Radio, I miss you so. Do 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 do.
Yes, it's Sunday. Time for the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show, presented by the makers of Rexall drug product. Good health to all from Rexall. And now your Rexall family druggist brings you the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show, written by Ray Singer and Dick Chevrolet, with Elliot Lewis, Walter Tetley, Robert North, Janine Roos, Ann Whitfield, Walter Scharf and his music, yours truly, Bill Foreman, and starring Alice Faye and Phil Harris. Contrary to popular belief, Phil Harris is a hard-working conductor who demands perfection from his orchestra. Right now, we find him in the library of his home, rehearsing one of his musicians.
Look, you still haven't got it. Now, I know you're new with my band, but you've got to learn to do things my way. That's what I like about the South. It's traditional with me, and it's got to be played in a certain tempo. Now, let's try it my way once. I'll give you the introduction. Ba da 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 de do do da 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 de do do da 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 do ba.
Won't you come with me to a... No! No, lady! No, lady! No! Lady, please!
No, I guess I was wrong. You can't play the harp my way. Put on your shoes and try it with your hands again. Why does Remley hire people like this? I can't understand. He knows very well.
Bill, will you please come in here a minute?
Okay, honey. Look, lady, if you're going to accompany me when I sing, you got to do it right. Now, look, I'll be right back. You stay here and keep practicing on that cabbage shredder. Just to think that... think I'm stuck with this dame for a whole year. Why did Frankie have
Bill,
to do
it? I've got to talk to you about Phyllis. She won't eat her lunch.
Won't eat?
No.
Why not?
Well, she has a boyfriend.
A boyfriend? Well, at long last. You know, I was getting kind of worried about her. She's 5 years old and she hasn't had a date yet.
Oh, Phil, be serious. I've tried to get her to eat, but she won't listen.
I'll handle it, honey. It takes a father to get a... I'll get the kid to listen. When I tell her something, she knows who's talking. Don't worry. Hey, Phyllis!
Yes, Calvin.
Look, Phyllis, I want... Calvin? Who's Calvin?
He's the man I'm going to marry.
Oh, him. What?
Calvin and I are being engaged today.
All right, that'll keep. Now, you sit down and eat.
I can't eat, Father. My little curly head can't think of food when my heart is so full of love.
Oh, no. My little curly head can't think of food when my heart is so full of love. Where'd she ever get anything that corny?
Out of one of the old love letters you wrote to me. It is corny, isn't it?
Well, from a child, yes. From me, it sounds kind of cute.
Phil, we've got to get Phyllis to eat.
She'll eat when she gets hungry. I'm worried about her boyfriend. Well, he's a bore to me already. And I'm worried about her. Where'd she meet him? What's he like? Who's his family? Is his father on the same intellectual level as I am? What does the old man do?
He's an associate professor of zoology at UCLA.
Zoology, huh? Well, it isn't fair to look down on him because of his job. After all, somebody has to feed the animals.
Well, Phil, he's a college professor. And his son, Calvin, is a very nice little boy. Phyllis brought him in and introduced him to me the other day.
Oh, she did, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, why didn't she introduce him to me? Who's the man in this house? Who runs things around here? Who's been supporting this family for the last 8 years? Wait! I better revamp that. No, but the least my daughter can do is to introduce her boyfriend to her father. What's the matter? Is she ashamed of me?
Oh, Phil, don't be so touchy. She just brought him in and... come to think of it, she made sure you weren't around before she brought him in.
Well, when a daughter's ashamed of her own father, a man has reached the end of his tether.
Oh, Phil.
Well, if I wasn't such an asset to mankind, I'd destroy myself. I never heard of anything like it, Alice, and I'm hurt. I never felt worse in my life.
Good morning, Philip.
That ain't gonna help either.
Hello, Alice, dear. I just met Phyllis and she introduced me to her boyfriend. Isn't he cute, Philip?
I wouldn't know.
He's a fine little fellow that... what's his name?
Calvert.
Calvin.
Well, I wouldn't know. I haven't been introduced to him.
You haven't? Well, what reason would Phyllis have for not introducing him to you?
I don't know. It seems that she's ashamed of me.
Oh, of course.
What do you mean? What's she got to be ashamed of me for? Is she ashamed because I'm a musician? Is she ashamed of the way I talk? Is she ashamed of the way I dress?
Mm-hmm.
Now look, Casper. There ain't nothing wrong with me being a musician. I talk as good as anybody, and I dress impeccably.
Still, maybe it is your clothes she objects to. Only yesterday I found her in your closet looking at your wardrobe and shaking her head.
But why? I could understand it if I was a loud dresser. I don't own a single loud garment.
Look, even you must admit that some of the clothes you brought back from London are outlandish.
Well, wait a minute now. Just a minute. You're going a little too far. I'm proud of my English clothes.
Including that double-breasted vest you got over there?
Vest? Oh, I say, old girl, you must be referring to my waistcoat. You Americans are so droll.
No, we spent 2 weeks in London and... Oh, excuse
wait
me.
Wait a minute, now, just wait a minute. I want to talk to you. And Alice, come back here.
Sorry, Governor, I've got the work to do, you know.
The nerve of her ridiculing my beautiful red and yellow plaid waistcoat. Why, it's the pride of my wardrobe. Hey, tell me the truth, Willie. Did you ever see anything like it?
Yes, once when I was at the slaughterhouse, I saw them...
Never mind! Take your umbrella and rubbers and go home. I can't understand why Phyllis avoids me. I'm a pal to her. Last night, before she went to sleep, I told her the story of the Jabberwocky bird from Alice in Wonderland.
What's that?
Curl up in the fireplace and I'll tell it to you. One time there was a mountaineer who felt so mighty brave that he took his trusty gun and went to a dark, dark cave. The reason for his venture was a story that he'd heard about a bad, ferocious creature called the Jabberwocky Bird. Now, when he got into that dreary cave, our hunter saw a sight. The Jabberwocker had 7 heads, and each one was a fright. He turned around and headed home, or running all the way. And then to all the folks who waited there, the mountaineer did say, "'Twas brillig and the slyly toasted gyre and gimble in the wabe. Old mimsy were the borogroves and the moray wraps out grabe. Oh, frabjous day, kalookalay, and from yous bandersnatch. My aim was spoiled by 7 heads, but that bird I will catch." Then back again into the cave that mountaineer did go. But how he'd finally get that bird, he really didn't know. This time the mountaineer was armed with knives and traps and bait. He had to catch that Jabberwocker, meet a sorry fate. Inside the cave, that gruesome bird confronted him once more. The mountaineer had 7 fits and fell to the floor. He offered up a hasty prayer and murmured, "It's the end." But 7 Jabberwockies said, "Can't we please be friends?" They brillicked in the slyly tove and gyre and gimber in the wave. We'll mimsy in the borogroves and the mommy rats out grave. Oh, frabjous day, kalookalay, and from yous bandersnatch. The mountaineer said, "You mean we're pals?" And 7 heads said, "Natch." Now the mountaineer just shook his head. He couldn't trust his ears. The Jabberwocky's 7 pairs of eyes were filled with tears. The ugly bird broke down and sobbed, "A witch made me like this. And Jabberwocky I must be until a man I kiss." The mountaineer could not resist that bird's unhappy plea. He bravely puckered up his lips and said, "You'll soon be free." They kissed and 7 heads became just 1 of golden curls. The ugly Jabberwock was then the prettiest of girls. They brillied in the slyly toves and gyred and gimbered in the wave. They mimsied in the borogroves and the moray wraps out grave. Oh, frabjous day, kalookalay, and from yous bandersnatch. The couple now have 7 kids, and that is quite a badge. Well, that's the story, and... Well... Look at Willie, sound asleep. With his ruler and pencil in his mouth. I got a fine family. He falls asleep while I'm singing. Alice finds fault with my clothes, and worst of all, my daughter avoids me. I ain't got a friend in the world.
Hi, Curly.
Frankie, it's you.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah. I just dropped in to say hello.
Yeah. But it means more than just hello to me right now. A real friend seems to know when to show up, doesn't he?
If you say so.
You know something? There's a silent bond between us, Remley. You didn't know I needed you, and yet you came here.
Why? Why?
The pool room was closed. I had no place else. Hey, Curly, what's bothering you?
Oh, Frankie, little Phyllis has a boyfriend, and she won't even bring him in to meet me.
Billy got a boyfriend? Well, that ought to make you proud.
Well, it does, but I'd be prouder if I could meet my son-in-law.
Well, don't rush it. Phyllis will introduce him to you eventually. You know, you're not the kind of a guy anyone can meet too suddenly. You got time.
That's just it. I haven't got as much time as you think. The kids are growing up. Why, in no time, Phyllis will have a steady boyfriend. She'll get engaged, and before I know it, I'll be taking her up to the altar to give her away to another man. She'll be walking down the aisle on my arm. Then the minister will take her hand.
Someday
we'll join them in together.
We'll take our love together to the sky where we can be alone.
Billy, pull up, we are getting him.
Julius, go away, will you? I got enough trouble. My daughter Phyllis is ashamed of me.
No.
Yes. And feeling the way she does about me, there's no telling what little Phyllis might do. Hey, look, Julius, you're a kid. If I were your father, what would you do?
I'd never talk to my mother again.
Curly, you know, if what you say is true and you're standing in the way of your child's happiness, there's only one thing for you to do.
What's that?
Clear out. Leave home.
Yeah. Tibet's nice this time of the year.
Well, if it meant their happiness, I'd even leave home and I'd... No. No, I can't. If I went away, who'd take care of Alice and the kids?
Well, seeing as Julius and me are in on that, Julius and me will share that responsibility. We'll take care of your wife and kids.
Yeah, I'll take care of Miss Faith.
I'll take care of the kids.
No, you don't. This is my idea. I get first choice.
I'm too young to take care of kids. I'm going to take care of Miss Faith.
No, you're not. I'm arranging this thing and I'm...
Hold it, hold it.
Now, look here, you guys.
Oh, are you back? I thought you were in Tibet.
Now, cut that out. I got a problem, and you two guys ain't helping me any. Oh, if I could only find out for sure why Phyllis is ashamed of me.
Why don't you make her tell you?
Yeah, sure. That's exactly what I'll do. I'll make her tell me if I have to spank it out of her.
Mr. Harris, such barbarianism. That ain't the subtle way to handle us little tykes. You gotta remember that our immature minds are delicate mechanisms that must be approached with discreet finesse. The sensitivity of our juvenile brains has a hairline precision, and nothing must be done to upset that equilibrium. Thought you gentlemen agreed.
Monsieur Remley, voulez-vous très bien avec moi ce soir?
Je ne sais pas beaucoup.
Hey, you guys, fuck it!
We will if you will.
All I'm trying to tell you is you should approach this psychologically. You understand that way, don't you?
Of course I do. What do you think I am, a dope or something? Monsieur Remley, voulez-vous très bien...
Ah, what's the use? I'm leaving.
Goodbye, Julius.
Bon sour, Philippe.
Hey, Remley, what was that little character batting about?
He means you should use child psychology on Phyllis.
Child what?
Psychology. Simple. It's a... Well, it's an approach to... That is, you... You got any books here on it?
Yeah, Alice must have. Let's look at that book, those books on the shelves.
All right, let me see. Ah, here it is, Curly. Psychiatry and its application.
I thought you said the word was psychology.
Psychology, psychiatry, same thing.
You sure?
Do I ever lead you wrong, Curly? Really? Ah, look, here's the chapter you want. Treatment of the Female Patient.
Let me see that book.
Here you are, right there.
Where were you reading?
Here.
Oh, yeah, I see. Wait a minute. The patient must be approached scientifically.
That's weird. Huh?
Yeah, we suggest asking the following questions until the patient is served.
Can I go out and... Oh, I'm sorry, Daddy. I didn't know you were here.
Wait a minute, Phyllis. Come on in here. Come back. Look, I want to ask you a few questions.
About what?
Well, about... Well, I look at the book. Oh, yeah. Now, look. Young lady, lie down on this couch. Give your subconscious mind full rein and tell me all about your sordid past.
Huh? What does sordid mean, Daddy?
Well, it means, Monsieur Remley, voulez-vous, baby? I'll ask her.
Ask me what, Uncle Frankie?
Now. Just relax, child. We're trying to help you. Now then, tell me, why do you hate your mother?
I don't hate my mommy.
She ain't cooperating.
Oh, give me back that. Will you? Here, give it to me. Now look, honey, this is almost the last question. Now listen closely. When did you first notice your marital incompatibility?
Well, don't stall. Answer me. You know what it means, don't you?
Well, Monsieur Remley, voulez-vous...
Stop that! Hey, Remley, incidentally, what is that marital incompatibility?
Curly, your ignorance is appalling. Really, very simple. The word marital refers to marching music for soldiers. The word compatible means to fight, therefore incompatible means not to fight. Put them together and we have a phrase meaning a soldier who does not want to fight.
Sounds logical. Phyllis, I'm going to have to rephrase my last question. Now listen. When did you first become a draft dodger?
No. Don't sound right when you say it, Curly. The question should be asked so
oh,
that
the keep quiet, Remley, draft dodger. You and your psychology. I'll handle this thing my way. Now look, Phyllis, I'm going to come right out and ask you, why are you ashamed to introduce me to your boyfriend? It can't be because of my clothes. You said you love my English vest.
Yes? Oh, Daddy, I'd rather not talk about it. See you later, Daddy.
Well. I guess I got my answer. She just doesn't like my clothes.
Guess not.
And there's only one thing for me to do. If it means my child's happiness, I'll get rid of my entire wardrobe. I'm going to give it all to charity.
Phil, what did you say to Phyllis? She came out shaking like a leaf.
I know, honey. I'm sorry, but I at least found out what's bothering her, and I'm going to fix it. It's my clothes she's ashamed of, so I'm going to send my entire wardrobe to the Salvation Army.
Well, what are you picking on them for? They never did anything to you.
All right. I won't give them to them. I'll give them to the Musicians Union.
Those guys will wear anything. I'll help you pack, and I'll take the stuff over to the Union Hall.
Oh, thanks, Frankie. You're a pal. Let's do
it.
Hey, see you later, honey. Gee, I hate to part with my beautiful English waistcoat.
Phil, I think you're being a little hasty. Oh, well, it's no use. Once he makes up his mind, what a guy.
Love somebody, yes I do. Love somebody, yes I do. Love somebody, yes I do. Love somebody, but I won't say who. Big and strong, bold and gay, he's not very, very far away. I would marry him today, but who he is I will not say. Because I love somebody, yes I do. Love somebody, yes I do. Love somebody, yes I do. Love somebody, but I won't say who.
Love somebody, love somebody,
love somebody.
Love somebody, but I won't say who. Handsome, say he's 6 feet tall, and his picture's on my wall. Hope he doesn't pass me by, 'cause if he did, I'd die. I know I'd die.
Love somebody.
Yes, I do.
Love somebody.
You know I do.
Love somebody.
Yes, I do.
Love somebody, but I won't say who. Don't know why he acts so shy,
'cause he's such a manly guy.
Hope he doesn't pass her by,
'cause if he did, I'd die. I know I'd die. I
love somebody.
Yes, I do.
Love somebody.
Yes, I do.
Love somebody.
Yes, I do.
I love somebody, but I won't say.
Well, Alice, Frankie took all my loud clothes over to Union Hall.
Phil, I don't think
No. From now on, I'm the new Harris. I'm going to be more formal. Like this here suit I got on. Yes, sir. If you'll excuse me now, I'm going out and meet Phyllis's boyfriend.
Oh, Phil.
Yeah?
You think you ought to go out 3 o'clock in the afternoon wearing a tuxedo?
Well, honey, it's the only dark suit I got. Now, come on with me. I want you to introduce me to the boy. Hey. I hope I make a good impression on my future son-in-law. I wonder where they are.
Phil. There's Phyllis and her boyfriend sitting on the swing.
Yeah.
Cute, huh?
Yeah, they're swinging.
Yeah.
Hey, he's a nice-looking boy.
Mm-hmm.
Good-shaped head. Not too pointed. Shh, Alice. Hey, Alice. You wait here. I'm going to sneak up behind them and see if I can hear what they're saying.
But, Calvin, when men and women get engaged, they're supposed to kiss. Now, kiss me.
Oh, stop nagging.
But you have to do something when you get engaged.
Let's wrestle. Come on, I'll get up and show you some new holes. Hey, Phyllis, did you order a lemonade or something?
No, why?
There's a waiter standing in back of you.
Waiter?
Oh, Calvin, this is my daddy.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Harris. I didn't know.
Oh, that's all right, Calvi. So you're engaged to my daughter, huh? Have a cigar, son. Hey, let me look at you. You're...
Daddy, Calvin has to go now.
I do not.
Please, go, Calvin, before he notices you're wearing his V-E-S-T.
Shh. You'll get W-I-S-E.
Ain't that cute? Spelling out their words of endearment. Hey, Cal, don't go. I want to know you better. I like your looks. Gee whiz, you're so manly and awful sloppy dresser, though. Hey, tell me, kid, is that a double-breasted life jacket you're wearing, or... Wait a minute. That's my English waistcoat. Now, where'd you get that?
I gave it to him as an engagement present. Daddy, you see, we both like what you wear so much that I thought that
you'd best... You like my clothes? You mean you didn't introduce Calvin to me because he was wearing... Oh, no. I gave everything away, and you gave him my waistcoat.
Don't worry, Daddy. We got something even better in return. Calvin gave me the most beautiful engagement present a girl ever got.
Yeah? What did he give you?
A pair of matched frogs.
My English waistcoat for two frogs? Phyllis, it's not a fair exchange.
You're right, Daddy. Calvin, here's one of your frogs back.
This program was produced and directed by Paul Phillips. The part of Frankie Remley was played by Elliot Lewis. And Julius was played by Walter Tetley. Alice Faye appeared through the courtesy of 20th Century Fox. This is Bill Foreman wishing good health to all from Rexall. Sunday is fun day on NBC. Stay tuned to this station for the Edgar Bergen, Charlie McCarthy show, which follows immediately.
From October of 1948, it's been the Phil Harris and Alice Faye show with a new suit of clothes. In a moment, Elliot Lewis starring in The Casebook of Gregory Hood and the Daphne Bloggs case, as this edition of Yesteryear continues.
Listening to some of the vintage radio programs and voices from America's past serves to remind us just how much times have changed. We fought wars to protect our freedom. We've overcome national adversity. Even how we relate to each other as Americans has come a long way since many of those vintage shows first aired. So if you hear an occasional reference that seems out of place or off color by today's standards, remember the vintage programs we played are offered in their historical context. As Americans, we've come so far in many ways. However, exploring where we came from is important in appreciating what we have today. A slice of America's entertainment past from KCEA. The sounds of the golden age of radio continue with Yesteryear. Here's Craig Roberts.
The Casebook of Gregory Hood was an imaginative piece of mystery adventure coming to Mutual in June of 1946 as a summer replacement for Sherlock Holmes. Initially, it ran just one season, but resurfaced periodically in summer slots and eventually had another full season in 1949-1950 for ABC. Casebook grew out of a long-distance collaboration of writers Anthony Boucher and Dennis Green. Green lived in Los Angeles, Boucher in San Francisco. They conceived Gregory Hood as a San Francisco importer dealing with rare items. Hood traveled around the world seeking artifacts for his import house. Each item found by Hood had an intriguing history and was inevitably linked to some present-day mystery. Gail Gordon starred as Hood when the show opened on Mutual. Another show heard on Mutual in the summer of 1948 featured Elliot Lewis as Hood and Howard McNear as Sandy. Return with us now to those fabulous days of yesteryear and the Casebook of Gregory Hood with the Daphne Bloggs case from September of 1946. Another classic radio moment from the archives of yesteryear.
The Casebook of Gregory Hood. Tonight, the Petri family, the family that took time to bring you good wine, invite you to listen to the story of Gregory Hood, Suspect. Another exciting adventure from the Casebook of Gregory Hood. Once again, it's Monday night in San Francisco, and time for our weekly date with Gregory Hood and his friend and attorney, Sanderson Taylor. Tonight, Greg suggested we rendezvous at that gourmet's paradise, Emilio's, on Powell Street. Let's join him there, shall we?
Hello there, Harry.
Good evening, Greg. How are you, Mr. Taylor?
Fine, thank you, Harry.
Well, we just ordered a couple of sherries, Harry. Shall I make it three?
Swell, Greg. I'd like one.
I'll make that three, Mario.
Yes, Mr. Hood.
Well, Greg, how's about tonight's story? From the hint you gave us last week, it sounded like quite a yarn.
It was, Harry. Though if Greg had listened to me, he'd never have been mixed up in the mess.
If I listened to you, Sandy, I'd keep out of a lot of trouble, I'm sure, but I'd probably die of boredom. In any case, I always was a sucker for beauty and distress.
That's the way a good many stories of yours start, it seems to me.
Oh, me, I'm just the poor man, Sir Walter Raleigh.
Who is this particular damsel in distress?
A sultry brunette by the name of Daphne.
Daphne Bloggs.
Oh, now we'll skip the blogs, Sandy. It strikes a discordant note. Daphne was a girl I'd known quite well when I was staying down in Burlingame a couple of summers ago. I lost track of her for a while, and then we ran into each other at the theater a few weeks ago. I was catching a performance of that swell play, The Hasty Heart.
Oh, yeah.
During intermission, I was getting some air when a voice behind me said...
Hello, Greg.
Daphne. Well, how nice to see you again.
Thanks, Greg. I saw you inside, so I thought I'd catch you at intermission and say hello.
Well, I'm glad you did. How about some supper after the performance tonight?
Well, yes, I suppose so.
Said she with violent enthusiasm. Oh, what's wrong, Daphne? Where's that champagne sparkle you used to have? Haven't you been getting the proper vitamins lately?
Greg, I'm in trouble. Desperate trouble.
I'm sorry, Daphne. What's wrong?
I'm being blackmailed.
Blackmailed?
Greg, I'm frantic.
Now, wait a minute, darling. Take it easy. Uncle Greg's in charge now. Now, let's step over here. Now, let's get the deal straight. Who's trying to blackmail you and what's his hold?
Read this note. I found it pinned to the seat of my car when I started out tonight.
Uh-huh. Plain manuscript paper typed in capitals. Blackmail as usual, bold approach. If you don't wish your father to have proof of last week's convenient car breakdown in Reno, bring $1,000 to the office of Jethro Bronson on Montgomery. If you don't tell the story, with photostatic copy of proof will be sent to your father. Dirty rats. Do you know this Jethro Bronson, Daphne?
No, Greg, I've never heard of him.
What's the true dope on this Reno story?
Oh, it's all perfectly innocent. I was up there with Martin Johnson last Friday.
Martin Johnson, he's married, isn't he?
Of course, his wife's my best friend. She's in New York, and Martin and I thought it'd be fun to drive up to Reno for the day and do some gambling.
I see.
We started back late, and the car did break down. We couldn't get it fixed, and we had to spend the night in an auto court. But it was all perfectly innocent, Greg.
Well, couldn't you explain that to your father?
You remember, Dad. He's Victorian to the core.
Oh, yes, I seem to recall that he asked me my intentions the first time I called on you. Of course, I didn't tell him.
He'd never understand. In any case, I've already lied to him simply because I knew he wouldn't believe the truth. I said I spent Friday night with a girlfriend, and he checked on that alibi. Of course, the girl backed me up.
And now, if you did tell him the truth, he'd think the worst, huh?
Of course he would. Greg, what am I going to do? I can't go to the police because they go straight to Dad. I certainly can't raise $1,000.
Well, even if you could, darling, I wouldn't let you hand it over.
Then what can I do?
Uncle Greg will take care of it. First of all, let's go back and see the rest of the show. After that, we'll go out to supper, and I'll make a phone call.
Now, Greg, please be careful what you say.
Now, don't worry, Daphne. I'm going to call Sandy Taylor. He's my pal and a very smart attorney, and discretion is his middle name. I think this is a case where we don't make any move without taking legal advice.
I do that blackmailers seldom stop at one payment.
Sure, but I've no intention of letting her make any payment. She hasn't the dough in any case. Sandy, have you ever heard of this guy, Jethro Bronson?
Never. I looked him up in the phone book while I was talking to you, though.
Oh?
He's got offices on Montgomery Street, all right.
Well, I think I'll call on him in the morning as Daphne's representative.
Better let me go, Greg. I can handle him.
Oh, but you're so doggone ethical, Sandy. With a rodent like this, a clip on the jaw could do a lot more good than throwing 20 books of law at him. Now, Sandy, I think I'll call on Mr. Jethro Bronson.
Well, okay, Greg, but watch your step. Blackmailers usually know all the answers.
I'll watch it, Sandy. But don't be surprised if you hear a squeal for help from Montgomery Street in the morning. I have a feeling I may land myself in a whole mess of trouble.
I'm Miss Carter, Mr. Bronson's secretary, Mr. Hood. You have no appointment.
No, Miss Carter, but I think if you tell him I'm a friend of Daphne Bloggs, he'll see me.
Miss Daphne Bloggs. Just a moment, please. Mr. Bronson will see you, Mr. Hood.
Well, the name of Bloggs works miracles, doesn't it? Thank you, Miss Carter.
You're welcome.
Yeah, come and sit down, Mr. Hood.
I'll walk around, thanks. You have quite an office, Mr. Bronson.
I'm so glad you like it. I do.
I was admiring the chaste simplicity of your lettering on the outer door. Jethro Bronson. Nothing more.
Is more necessary?
You might have added abandoned hope, all ye that enter here, or something equally appropriate.
I don't think that I understand you, Mr. Hood.
Sure, you're just a bewildered businessman who can't understand a new client. Hey, you have a swell view of the bay from here, as far as I can judge by peering through these dirty windows.
You're due for a cleaning, Mr. Hood. And so is Daphne Bloggs. I presume you represent her.
I do.
You brought the money?
Ah, the businessman is confused no longer. No, Bronson, I didn't bring the money. I thought first I'd like to see the evidence.
You can see a photostatic copy of it. Here.
Ah. Bronson, you'd have to get on a stepladder to pass the time of day with a louse, wouldn't you?
Very funny, Mr. Hood.
You own these auto courts, Bronson?
Yes. It was a profitable investment.
I'll bet, especially when you can fix up the registrations this way. You knew that Miss Blogg's father was a rich man, I suppose?
Mr. Hood, I assure you I know all that's necessary about the family. When do I get the money?
I'll give you a check now.
A check? Oh, no, Hood, I'm no fool. I want cash, and I want unmarked bills of low denomination, and I'd like the cash today.
Okay. I'll go over to the bank.
Hood, I don't like the way you're fingering that paper knife of mine. Don't let its sharpness give you any stupid ideas. I have a revolver in this drawer, you know.
Don't worry, Bronson. If I did anything to a rat like you, I wouldn't use a knife. I'd use... Yeah, why not?
Get away from me!
Ah, that was a pleasure. Have a nice nap, Mr. Bronson. I'll be back in a flash with the cash.
$90, $100, $1,000, Mr. Hood.
You got the numbers on these bills, Barney?
Yeah. Up to some new trickery on one of your cases?
Well, fairly old trickery, I'm afraid. Thanks.
Just a minute. I'll let you out.
Oh, you locked up?
Yeah. You got in just under the wire. Well, Mr. Hood, good luck with your tricks.
Luck? Thanks. I have a hunch I may need it.
You wish to see Mr. Bronson again, Mr. Hood?
I don't wish to, but I have to, Miss Carter.
Senator Harrison is waiting to see him, too.
Oh, well, I'll take my turn. How are you, Senator?
Oh.
I haven't seen you since that last get-together at Bohemian Grove.
Well, bless my soul, it's young Gregory Hood. How are you, my boy?
Fine, thank you, sir. And what is the great politician doing here, may I ask? Or maybe I shouldn't.
I have certain business with this fellow Bronson. And what, may I ask, is the celebrated Gregory Hood doing here?
Certain business also, Senator.
Uh-huh.
Oh, Mr. Hood, I didn't realize you were the Gregory Hood.
I'm flattered that you've heard of me, Miss Carter. Just the same, what's the chance of accelerating our interviews with Mr. Bronson? He is in, isn't he?
Yes, he's talking on long distance. I'll see if he's through.
Thank you.
Hood.
Yeah?
You've had dealings with this man Bronson before?
No, Senator. This is my first unhappy experience.
Well... He's an unmitigated scoundrel, Hood. I've often thought that I...
What the devil? What's wrong, Miss Carter?
Oh, get the police!
The police! Now look here, young lady.
What happened?
It's Mr. Bronson. He's been murdered.
The police are taking the devil's own time with their examination, Sergeant. Why don't they question us? I'm a busy man.
I'm sorry, Senator, but there's nothing I can do.
Well, who's in charge of this case, Sergeant?
Lieutenant Magruder, Mr. Hood.
Magruder, huh? Well, that makes it tough for me. Where's Lieutenant Silvers?
He's on vacation, Mr. Hood.
Oh, then I am in trouble. It's a good thing I put in a call to Sandy Taylor. I may need a smart attorney.
Okay, Miss Carter. Don't leave the office. Come in, Hood.
Hmm. But, Lieutenant, I'm a very busy man. Can't you take me first?
No, Senator, you'll have to take your turn. Come on, Hood. Sit down.
I find your old-world charm irresistible. Thank you, Lieutenant.
Hood, I've waited a long time to catch you out on a limb. Now I've done it.
Why do you hate me so much, Magruder?
Because you're an amateur dick who thinks he can make monkeys out of the police. We don't tell you how to run your business. Why do you make you submit yourself up with ours?
I don't. Consciously, it mixes itself up with me.
Is that a fact? Well, you're mixed up in this one, but good. Let me see your right hand.
Oh, it's a little dirty, what's that?
No. Your knuckle skin. There's a bruise on the corpse's chin. You socked him, didn't you, Hood?
Yes, Sherlock, I did.
Why?
Because I didn't like him.
Why were you here? We know he was a blackmailer, though we could never pin anything on him. Do you have something on you?
On me? No.
Then you were stooging for somebody else. Who was it?
I ain't talking, as they say, Magruder.
Well, you'll talk to the judge, Hood, because I'm arresting you on suspicion of murder.
Well, that's very interesting. If you do that, Magruder, you'll end up with those tired arches of yours pounding a beat again.
Skip the comedy, Hood. It won't get you off this spot.
Oh, Greg.
Sandy, I'm certainly glad to see you.
Yeah, I got here as fast as I could, Greg.
Lieutenant Magruder, meet my attorney, Sanderson Taylor.
You don't have to introduce us, Hood. Mr. Taylor and I know each other.
Yes, what goes, Greg?
The lieutenant's got a vacancy for me in death row, I think.
Mr. Taylor, I'm just about to arrest your friend on suspicion of murdering Jethro Bronson.
What? On what evidence?
He admits that he slugged the dead man.
That doesn't prove murder, Lieutenant.
But this paper knife does. Bronson was stabbed with it. I powdered it for fingerprints. Your prints are on it, Hood. I had them checked.
This fast?
Uh-huh. I've been looking forward to this day ever since that fisherman's wharf business.
Oh. You really do have it in for me, don't you, Lieutenant?
Great. Did you handle this knife?
Sure I did, but I didn't stab the guy with it. Can I look at those prints on the knife, Lieutenant?
Yeah, but don't handle it.
Don't worry, I won't mess up Exhibit A.
I want to arrest him, Mr. Taylor.
If you do, Lieutenant, I'll have him out on a writ before you can spell habeas corpus.
Well, that should give us several hours' start.
Oh, very funny, Mr. Hood. But you're not going to laugh your way out of this one.
Hey, Magruder, even though you hate me, I'd like to save your badge and your arches. Come here.
What is it, Grant?
You're planning to book me on the evidence of these prints, Lieutenant?
Sure.
And I'd like to point out a small inconsistency. The faint old prints are Bronson's, I suppose.
Yeah?
And these two heavy new ones are mine?
Sure they are.
Fine. But there are only two prints. The thumbprint on the face of the handle, the forefinger print on the back. That's the way you hold a knife when you play with it, as I did, or when you open letters. But you couldn't possibly hold it that way and only two fingers to stab a man.
Why, of course not. If you were stabbing a man, the prints of all the fingers would be on the handle.
What do you say, Lieutenant?
I guess you're right. But why aren't there murderer's prints on here?
I'd say the answer to that would be a pair of gloves. And if you want to make an issue of my prints being on the knife, I'll be very happy. It's perfect evidence that I didn't kill Jethro Bronson.
Okay, Hood. You've talked yourself out of this one for a minute or two. But before this case is over, I'm warning you. This is going to be the last chapter in the casebook of Gregory Hood.
Things are swinging. This is Fred Hall with Swing Thing, a show that digs the collector's files and brings you right up to today as well. The sounds of the big bands and the great gems of jazz and the swinging singers of the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. There are celebrity guests in person, all from the world of swing. Swing Thing.
Swing Thing. Thursday evenings at 6 on the home of the big bands, 89.1 KCEA. The sounds of the golden age of radio continue with Yesteryear.
Greg, for a moment there, you had me worried. I thought my favorite amateur detective was going to be arrested for murder.
For a moment there, I had me worried. Lieutenant Magruder's a tough hombre, and Gregory Hood is very far from his favorite detective.
But he let you go.
Yes. And Sandy and I gravitated to the Prosperity Corner bar and quickly went into a huddle.
Oh, Greg, you're still under suspicion, and we've got to clear you.
Very true, Sandy, and the more I brood about the case, the more I incline to one opinion.
Huh? And that is?
Well, Sandy, Magruder told us what Miss Carter testified.
Yes. She said that she talked to Bronson before he made the phone call. She came into the outer office where you and Senator Harrison were waiting. And the next time she went in, Bronson was dead.
Exactly, which would mean that if her testimony is true, that she's the only person who could have committed the murder. Unless, of course, an especially adroit seagull flew through his window and did the deed.
If she did stab him, it wouldn't be hard to think of a motive. I've known people before who worked for blackmailers, simply because their employer was blackmailing them, too.
Sure, but if she were the killer, surely she'd dream up an alibi.
Yeah. Maybe she saw you handling the knife. I thought your fingerprints would pin the rap on you.
Well, it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Or it might have been Senator Harrison. It's pretty obvious that he wasn't there purely for a social call.
Yes, Sandy, I can see the possibility of motive. It's the how of this killing that worries me. The dead man's office was on the 9th floor.
Uh-huh.
The only exit was through his door. Miss Carter saw him alive, walked outside to where the senator and I were waiting. She goes back a few minutes later, he's dead.
Yeah. Well, the evidence would certainly point towards the secretary. Say, Greg, how's about the girl Daphne Bloggs? She'd know as well as we do that Bronson's death would put her in the clear. That's a good murder motive in itself.
Well, true, Sandy, but I repeat, how? Daphne's a very cunning girl, but she can't float through a window 9 stories high.
No, that's true. Looks like a blank wall, Greg, but we've got to get around.
Or over it. Well, Sandy, I think the next step is obvious.
They go and see the secretary, Miss Carter.
Right. Huh? I have her address. She lives on Russian Hill. But I'm worried.
Huh? Why?
I'm an ardent whodunit fan, and she's the obvious suspect. By all the rules, it can't be her. Oh, well, this is real life. Let's call on her and see what happens.
Hello?
Mr. Hood, I'll be glad to help you any way I can.
I thought you would be, Miss Carter.
You see, my friend is still under suspicion by the police.
I realize that, Mr. Taylor. And I must confess that if I hadn't known you were the Mr. Hood, I would have suspected you myself.
Well, you wouldn't have been the only one in your suspicion.
Miss Carter, did you know that your employer's profession was blackmail?
Blackmail? No, I certainly didn't. Though I did know he was crooked. A blackmailer. I wonder why Senator Harrison was there. Do you suppose Mr. Bronson had some hold over him and that the senator killed him?
When did he have the opportunity?
Oh, that's true. He never went past me, and there's no other door.
He didn't even go in after you left the office. He and I watched each other like hawkshaws until the police arrived.
You left the office, Miss Carter?
Yes, Mr. Taylor. After I called the police, I was sick.
What's your own theory, Miss Carter?
Well, I didn't have one until I looked at this newspaper, Mr. Hood. Have you seen it?
No. What ties in?
Well, I spotted this on the back page.
Huh?
Oh, I may be imagining things, but it seems to me that it might connect.
Hmm. What does it say,
Greg? You're a very smart girl, Miss Carter. Listen to this, Sandy. A man was arrested in Montgomery Street late this afternoon. He claimed to have been doped, but the police are holding him on a vagrancy charge.
What does that have to do with Bronson's murder?
Because it says here he was a professional window cleaner.
Well, I still don't see
I do. Bronson said that his windows were due for a cleaning. You can see what happened. The murderer doped the window cleaner, borrowed his equipment, worked his way around to Bronson's window, went in and stabbed him, and then made his getaway. It's the only way an outside person could have gotten in.
Then let's go and talk to the window cleaner, Greg.
Sure, Sandy. He's in jail, and that's one place that I'm sure will have no difficulty in gate crashing.
That's the way it was, Mr. Hood. I was standing in the corridor just filling my pipe, and I smell something sweet. Next thing I know, I'm down in the basement. Must have taken me down the service elevator.
Sounds like chloroform, Sandy.
Uh-huh, yes, sir. What time was this, Hank?
Oh, I don't know. Middle of the afternoon, I guess.
Well, don't you carry a watch?
No. My profession, it's too risky. Might fall down and break the bejeepers out of it.
Occupational hazard.
Yeah.
Have you any idea what time it was, Hank?
No, but it was sometime in the afternoon because I could hear a radio in one of the offices and they was giving the race results. And they're always at the same time in the afternoon.
How much of it did you hear?
The announcer was starting to give the results of the fourth race, just as he named the horse. It was Lady Bess. I heard that, and next thing I knew, I was waking up downstairs.
The track broadcast swell, Hank. Though you don't carry a watch, you've given me a dandy time check.
Well, how do you mean, Greg?
All I have to do is call the radio station. Hank was knocked out as the fourth race was announced. As soon as I know the time of that, I think we'll have the answer to murder. Yeah? Yeah. Well, then the fourth race was announced at exactly 12 minutes past 3. I'm much obliged to you. There's our time check, Sandy.
Well, I don't get it, Greg.
I think I do. This whole case revolves around time. The bank closes at 3. How long do you suppose it took me to walk from there to Bronson's office?
Well, it isn't more than a block, a couple of minutes.
Just about, and maybe another minute in the elevator. I think this gives us the answer, Sandy. Let me make another phone call to Lieutenant Magruder, and then we'll go back to Miss Carter's apartment on Russian Hill. I think that's where we're going to get the final payoff.
It was very nice of you to bring me a corsage, Mr. Hood.
Well, I think you deserved one, Miss Carter. If you hadn't spotted that item about the window cleaner, this case might still be unsolved.
They've arrested the murderer?
Magruder's got a warrant out.
Who is it?
Well, Sandy's an attorney. Let him lay it on the line for you.
Well, this whole case revolves around the matter of time.
Very true, Sandy. Go on.
The killer, after drugging the window cleaner, had to take his belt, crawl out, and work his way around to Bronson's window. Now, we know that the window cleaner wasn't drugged until 12 minutes past 3. You established that fact when you called the radio station.
Exactly, Sandy.
So, if the window cleaner wasn't drugged until 12 minutes past 3, the murder couldn't have been committed before 3:15.
That's the logical deduction, Sandy. And it's also where the whole case blows up.
Why?
How do you mean, Mr. Hood?
Miss Carter, it's a problem in primary mathematics. I got to my bank at closing time. I was let out a few moments later. It took me 2 minutes to walk to the office building, say another minute in the elevator. I was in the office with you not more than a minute before you went in and found the corpse.
Well, I still don't understand, Mr. Hood.
Well, I'll go over it again and you count on your fingers, Miss Carter. I left the bank at 1 minute past 3, 2 minutes to walk to the office, a minute in the elevator, and a minute in the outer office would add up to 4, or at the latest, 5 minutes past 3. And at 5 minutes past 3, you went back in the office and he was dead.
Yes, Greg, that's right.
Uh-huh. But on the other hand, the window cleaner, who was to become our number one suspect, wasn't drugged until more than 5 minutes afterward.
Afterwards? But why, Mr. Hood?
Miss Carter, you make a pretty picture of innocence, but I don't know who you think you're fooling.
What do you mean?
The whole thing is obvious now. You killed Bronson. Then when the senator spoke to me, you realized I was the Mr. Hood, as you put it, so you knew it wasn't safe to frame me.
So she dreamed up the idea of drugging the window cleaner and then drew the fact to your attention?
Sure, Sandy. It was a neat idea, a very neat idea. If there hadn't been a cast iron time check on the whole deal. You're very quiet, Miss Carter.
You said that Lieutenant Magruder had a warrant out.
That was just to lead us into this conversation. Magruder wouldn't believe a word I say. But Lieutenant Silvers will be back soon. He'll believe me.
You'll never talk to him. Nor your friend either.
Put that revolver away, Miss Carter. Surely one murder a day is enough.
One or three, it doesn't make much difference, Mr. Taylor.
Why did you kill Bronson?
He was blackmailing me, too.
What hold did he have on you?
Well, my husband was overseas. I wasn't playing square.
And Bronson found out, huh?
Yes, and I only learned about it yesterday.
So you stabbed him and then dreamed up the window cleaner gag.
Yes. I knew that the windows were due to be cleaned today, and I suddenly saw how I could establish a perfect cover-up.
It was a perfect cover-up, Miss Carter. If it weren't for the fact that we can establish the time element...
Wait a minute, let me get this straight. You went into Bronson's office after I left. You found him where I knocked him out cold. You stabbed him. Then after you called the police, when you said you were sick, you left the office and drugged the window cleaner, took him down in the service elevator and hoped we'd fall for the idea that the murder had been committed by someone coming in through the window. Is that right?
Yes, that's what I'd hoped. It's a pity you had to be so smart. I really don't want to shoot you, but I must.
Miss Carter?
It's the only way.
Magruder!
Thank you. I'll take care of that gun. I came as soon as you called me, Hood. I didn't trust you, but I figured I might as well listen. I came up on the fire escape. Nice of the young lady to leave her window open.
Well, Magruder, you have your confession. And also, I hope you realize that you've got a nasty, suspicious mind where I'm concerned.
Okay, Hood. You were right. This time. And I don't mind getting at the rights of a case, even if an amateur has to help me. But one of these days, you're going to start something you can't finish.
I hope not, Lieutenant, but it's possible.
You're darn right it is. And when that happens, it's my last prayer every night that I'll be the cop on that case.
What a story, what a story. But say, Greg...
Yes, Harry?
I'm more convinced than ever that Magruder just doesn't like you.
Why, that couldn't be.
Oh, no?
Why, he's very solicitous about my health, seems determined that someday I'm going to take a long rest at San Quentin.
Possible.
Magruder doesn't think so, but carry on.
You bet, Greg. Which story out of your casebook are you planning to tell us next week?
An adventure that took place under the big top of a San Francisco circus a few months ago, Harry. The story tells of a very colorful girl who trains snow leopards and of a sad clown whose first smile proved to be a smile of death. See you next Monday, Harry.
The Casebook of Gregory Hood is written by Dennis Green and Anthony Boucher. Original music composed and played by Dean Fossler. Elliot Lewis plays the part of Gregory Hood, and Sanderson Taylor is played by Howard McNear. The Petri Wine Company of San Francisco, California, invite you to tune in again next week, same time, same station. The Casebook of Gregory Hood comes to you from our Hollywood studio. This is Harry Bartell saying goodnight for the Petri family. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
From September of 1946, it's been Elliot Lewis starring in The Casebook of Gregory Hood and the Daphne Bloggs case. I'm afraid that's all the time we have today, but be with us again next week at the same time and invite a friend to listen. Together, enjoy more great moments from the golden age of radio. I'm Craig Roberts with those fabulous days of yesteryear. Till next time, so long.
Radio, remember radio. We'd sit and close our eyes and use our imagination. The comedy, mystery, the fireside chat. Together we sat, listening nightly to our favorite show. Radio, I miss you so. Do-de-o, do-de-o, do. Radio, I miss you so.
preceding program copyright Edgewater Productions. All rights reserved. Music you won't find.